hardly know what to say. Eddie Martinez, one of the best-known session guitarists in history, just left the cafe at Artichoke Music after nearly an hour of inspired conversation. Now look, I don't mean to disparage the over 400 other guests we've had on 10 years of OMN's Coffee Shop Conversations, but this one is at or near the top. It's the third time he's been on the podcast. I asked him to join me because he has a gig at Jack London Review on Friday, May 3rd. He also has a new EP on the way. We found out about both of those, but mostly we had a bracing conversation. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did, and I think he did too. Eddie, welcome back to the Artichoke Cafe.
Thanks so much, Tom. It's great to be here.
It's always nice to see you.
Good seeing you too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've seen some stuff about the shows you've got coming up. So let's get to that first.
Okay.
All right. You got one coming up at Jack London.
Yeah, next Friday. John Mazzocco and Ramsey Embick and Anthony Jones and myself. We're just going to, you know, kick it, play a bunch of tunes. And it's been a while. The last show for me was last August.
Wow.
So it's been a minute, but I've been doing some gigs out of town and stuff.
So Anthony Jones?
Yeah.
I don't know him.
Oh, Anthony's a great drummer. He started out playing with me, and then he went to play with Pink Martini for a few years, and then, you know, he decided just to change course, and, you know, and he's back here in town, so he's doing some gigs with me.
Well, you've got to have chops to play in Pink Martini.
Yeah.
Especially with that percussion section.
Yes.
Brian Davis and all those cats.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I've never seen the full-fledged band. I've heard them, but never really seen them live.
I was at
a thing with Thomas Lauderdale.
Uh-huh.
It was at a private party kind of deal, and he sang some tunes with his vocalist.
China Forbes.
Yes.
Yeah,
that was cool.
Yeah, I was just at a fundraiser for a woman making a movie about the life and death of Derek Reith. I don't know if you ever knew him.
No, I didn't.
He was a percussionist in Pink Martini and the Lions of Batucada and this and that. He killed himself about 10 years ago, and they're finally finishing up a documentary on him.
Mm-hmm.
He loved him. I mean, everybody loved him.
Wow.
So anyway, Mazzocco and Ramsey Embick.
Yes.
What a pair.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, great musicians, and it just kicks. And we're just doing a real potpourri, some originals, some eclectic covers, and, you know, just some big rock stuff. And, you know, that's my wheelhouse. I love playing that stuff.
Jeez.
And, you know.
The four of you could just not play anything and just sit there and tell stories, and everybody would love it.
A lot of stories between us all.
There are
a bunch of stories.
Mazzocco on the road with John Lee Hooker.
Yep.
And Curtis Salgado, and of course,
yes,
Ramsey with the Pointer Sisters and all those people.
Yeah,
that
was MD
for
them years ago.
And yeah.
Extraordinary players, really, all of them.
Yeah. I just saw him play a solo gig. Because if you remember years ago, he would do a solo gig at the Blue Monk.
Okay.
And he should try this on him sometime. And nobody ever came. But I did. But the thing is, you could call out any famous jazz pianist. Just call his name out. Say, Bud, Bud Powell. And he would just start playing exactly like Bud Powell.
Wow.
And any other great pianist. It was amazing.
That's amazing.
Does that. Yeah.
I love that. You know, all the different flavors of all the different iconic pianists through the years.
Yeah.
That's awesome stuff.
That is an extraordinary combination of personalities and talents.
Oh, indeed. Yeah, because you have to absorb the vibe of the particular person you're emulating and kind of vibe in. It's even more than just a duplication. It's really just like capturing a spirit, of an artist. And
do you guys even have to rehearse?
Yeah, we do rehearse because some of the music is it's big music, and you have to be articulate when you're playing large sounding things. Uh-huh. And,
like what, for instance?
You know, like say if we do Manic Depression, you know, uh-huh. a Hendrix uh-huh. tune, you know.
Wow.
That's a big tune. It has to be precise. Or say if we're doing Human Beings by Seal, uh-huh. which is really kind of enormous in its scope uh-huh. And also the content, the lyrical content as well. And then, you know, there are lots of different styles of songs. There's a song we cover by Archangels called Too Many Ways to Fall, huh. which is really, the lyric is really, really powerful and uh-huh. it's potent. Uh-huh. And you really want to try to get the lyric across and, you yeah. know, and get the sentiment, mm-hmm. you know.
And, of course, you do the vocals.
Yeah, I'm doing yeah. the vocals. Yeah. And, you know, I used to have background singers. I would love to endeavor that again. But for a one-off gig, it's
right.
it's just a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know, because
yeah.
the detail with some of the tunes harmonically, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah.
like we're doing a George Harrison tune, All Things Must Pass, which
oh,
is
yeah.
a great song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the lyrics are so profound and...
Yeah.
You know, I love it, and it's just—it's not a tune where you're blowing. It's just a tune where you're just singing,
uh-huh.
and you're emoting what the spirit and the content of the song.
Uh-huh.
You know, I
wow.
love that as well.
Yeah, yeah. Boy, that's going to be a great gig.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Everybody
yeah.
should go hear it. I mean, what a collection.
Yeah, yeah. It's really eclectic. You know, and I like that we, you know, sometimes we'll do a, you know, a Curtis Mayfield cover, you
yeah.
know, a Bill Withers tune,
uh-huh.
you know, we'll probably do a Bill Withers tune. On
what Curtis Mayfield do you have in mind?
Oh, gosh. There was a Curtis Mayfield tune. I think it's called Almost Gone. I'm here, but I'm almost gone. Something like that.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah. oh, it's just the lyrics are just like really, they're hard.
Yes.
They're hard in, yeah. in the sense of the content,
mm-hmm.
you know.
As beautiful as his music is.
Yeah.
Pusher Man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because the content of the song is about, you know,
yeah.
about, you know, someone who's hooked up on drugs and just
right.
it's this cycle that repeats and
yeah.
and
yeah.
you know the sadness of it and
mm-hmm.
and how deep that could be in someone's life
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well, geez,
yeah,
that sounds great. Now I found this. I said, what did I'm gonna have to go into my phone here because we looked at something before this that was weird. There's an album you that you had up on Facebook, something that you had worked on a few years ago.
Oh, my next EP.
Yes.
Yes. It's called Elephant. And
that sounded like an interesting story.
It is an interesting story. Back in 95, believe it or not,
mm-hmm.
I went into the studio with some friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my dear friends, his name was Jason Corsaro, and he was a Grammy Award-winning engineer, real pioneer
mm-hmm.
of engineering, and was really one of the icons of recorded music
mm-hmm.
of that decade, the 80s and the 90s. He did everything from Madonna
wow.
to Soundgarden. He recorded Soundgarden, the Super Unknown album.
Mm-hmm.
Fleetwood Mac,
uh-huh.
Robert Palmer, Peter Gabriel.
Wow.
And then
any other Robert Palmer albums that you're on?
Oh yeah, Addicted to Love.
Wow.
Yeah, that album, uh-huh. that Riptide. He recorded everything.
Uh-huh.
He didn't mix it, but he recorded
uh-huh.
everything. Put everything down on tape.
Uh-huh.
Public Image Limited with Johnny Lydon and
Jeez.
Steve Vai and all these,
yeah.
you know, really, you know, just mm-hmm. Elvin Jones. I mean,
Elvin
really
Jones.
Eclectic, a real entire rainbow.
Did you ever get to see Elvin Jones?
Only on film, but
yeah,
not really
yeah.
in person. I would have loved to.
I saw him.
You know, I saw Billy Cobham play live, you
Whoa.
Know, and that was amazing. Jack DeJohnette.
Jack DeJohnette.
I've seen a lot of greats. I've played with a lot of greats,
I
too.
I loved that album of Jack DeJohnette's, the one with John Abercrombie and Lester Bowie.
Oh, wow. I knew John.
Did you?
Yeah, not well, but I remember I asked him if he'd give me some lessons. This is way, way back.
Yeah.
This is way back in the 70s. And so he had this apartment above a Chinese restaurant on the west side.
Uh-huh.
And so I went there, you know, and so he throws out a sheet of paper. It has all the modes. He says, yeah,
really?
Learn this.
And what did you say?
I said, okay, you know. So I dug into that for a minute, you know, and then that was the only lesson I took from him. Then I took a few lessons from Sal Salvador, but ostensibly, you know, self-taught.
Yeah.
You know, and Sal was real cool. He was a real disciplinarian, you know, and he was really fundamental. He really got into the fundamentals, and he was an extraordinary player, and a lot of books of his books are still in print. You know, and he was real cool. He says, oh, man, your eyes are faster than your ears. No, my ears are faster than my eyes, he said.
There you go.
You know, when it came to reading stuff and stuff like that. But he was wonderful. He was wonderful. You know, so he got me working on these etudes and stuff like that. And it was just really, really helped my chops a lot.
Wow.
Yeah.
I interviewed Abercrombie one time at a bar in D.C.
Oh, is that so?
Yes.
Yeah, I used to love it when he played with Michael Urbaniak, you know?
Oh, yeah.
There's a tune that they had called Chinatown, man.
And
that was
his
killing.
Wife.
Oh,
Urbaniak's
yeah.
Urbaniak's wife, Ursula Dudziak.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Great times.
It was that was a very interesting time in music.
Oh.
ECM days.
Yeah, I mean, there was so much shit going on in the 70s.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, you had the disco movement, right?
Right.
You had the explosion of John McLaughlin and, you know, Mahavishnu Orchestra, Return to Forever, Weather Report, you know, Michael Urbaniak, it was, and then you had the rock scene was still vibrant.
Sure.
And the punk scene was emerging. It was like, it was an explosion. New York back then was vibrant. It had its flaws, but now it's like, I go back and it's just, it doesn't feel the same way. Nothing should stay the same. Everything is fluid and it changes and stuff like that. But I think it must be extraordinarily difficult for artists that are just starting out and getting hitting the pavement relative to work and things like that. In my time, it was easier to get an apartment to live in that didn't cost much money.
Yeah.
You know, so you could still pursue your dreams. Now it's like you got to team up, like, you know.
Yeah.
You know. 5 or 6 people to pony up enough money to pay rent and then sleep on the floor in an apartment that you're paying. Yes. Hello.
So many people, millions of people, got turned on to jazz through the Mahavishnu Orchestra.
Oh, yeah.
That's how a lot of people got in.
Yeah.
You know, because they were rock fans, and then they heard this.
Oh,
they never heard anything like it.
It was so transformative. I remember the first time I heard Billy Cobham live.
Yes.
It was so interesting. It was at a rehearsal place in New York called Baggies, and I was around 18 years old, and I was early for rehearsal. But I heard this thundering sound coming down the hallway, so I, you know, it's just let me check this shit out, and so I walk into the room, and it's Billy Cobham, and he's playing with Jan Hammer. And he had just gotten his new drum set, and they were the plexiglass drums that he endorsed back in those days. They were called Fibes.
Yeah.
And they were clear plexiglass. And it was just extraordinary hearing those two guys just playing and just blowing and playing. Yeah. And it was so free, and it was so powerful. It was just like...
Power is the right word.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And it was amazing.
Yeah.
You know, and then I remember when Narda Michael Walden was playing with Mahavishnu in the second iteration of the band. And they did that album with Michael Tilson Thomas.
Oh, yeah.
And that was really big, that album, for me. Mm-hmm. And we used to rehearse in the same rehearsal studio. So I got to know Narda and John. And and I used to, you know, I mean, I've been in those rehearsals when they were rehearsing with Jean-Luc Ponty and Ralph Armstrong and Gail Moran. And... at SIR on 54th Street. I have great memories of that. Yeah. My friends and I, we were just starting out, man, but we're like, you know, we were so, it was just an amazing time.
It was.
Yeah.
I had Jean-Luc Ponty on as I was doing a TV show at Maryland Public TV at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had Jean-Luc Ponty on as a guest. But in that show, it was called The Critic's Place, and I never called myself a critic, but, because it's bullshit. But, but there were a whole bunch of other people who called themselves critics on this show.
Right.
And so he was a studio guest, and one of the other critics in the show. We had some film of him, fine, and so it's over, and we're starting to talk to him, mm-hmm. and one of the other guys goes, oh, Mr. Ponte, you play so beautifully, but why all this electric violin? And so Ponte goes, looks at him and goes, because I love it.
Good. Yeah.
Shut him up.
Yeah. You know, it's that, you know, the question is so laced with judgment.
Yeah.
And that's what's so fucked up.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's kind of like this highbrow, snooty shit.
Right.
That you should be playing some Stephen Grappelli stuff, like, yeah, you know, and locked into a hot jazz thing, quote unquote, and not explore and do other things. Not to put out the hot jazz stuff. I saw Stephen Grappelli at the Sanger Theater in New Orleans, uh-huh. you know, back in the day, and it was an extraordinary concert.
That's amazing.
But I'm just trying to articulate a point that there's judgment in that.
Yeah.
You know, just like there was judgment in George Benson in singing. You know, on his tunes. Right. And, you know, thank God he did that, because he had a wonderful career.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he doesn't have to play in clubs for like a $50 or $100 a night.
Right.
You know, and he's established himself as a transcendent artist and still one of the greatest guitar players in the world.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, you know, give me a break with that highbrow effete snobbery.
But it was the Mahavishnus who led people to Miles Davis and, of course, Tony Williams.
Yes.
Because that was, you know.
Oh,
if,
man.
If you heard Tony Williams with Miles, then you heard Billy Cobham with the Mahavishnus. You know, I mean, it was.
Oh my gosh, Tony Williams, man.
Tony Williams. Did you get to play with him?
I never got to play with him.
Oh.
But I did see him play several times.
Wow.
The last time I actually saw him, that I was on stage with him, was I was touring with Stanley Clarke and George Duke.
Uh-huh.
And we were playing at this huge jazz festival that they have in Japan every year. It's called Live Under the Sky.
Did they record that?
I'm not sure. They might have, but it was the VSOP band with Carlos Santana and his percussion section.
Whoa.
So it was a young Wynton Marsalis, because this was 1981.
Wow.
So Wynton was like probably not even 20 years old.
Yeah.
Right? And Ron Carter, Herbie, and Tony on drums. And I remember standing with Stanley. Stanley was right next to me, and Carlos's percussionist Armando Peraza.
Uh-huh.
And Armando said in Spanish, "Él es una sinfonía en la batería," and that means, you know, he's a symphony just on the drums alone.
Yeah,
and it was so true. I'll never forget that. Yeah. And we were just like, you know, we were enormous fans, and. Tony did call me. This was maybe late 80s or thereabouts. And he called me and he wanted me to come and play with him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just prior to him going into the hospital for that procedure that he never came out. So that never came to be, but that would have been a really extraordinary education for me to have worked with him.
You know, my favorite version of A Moment's Notice is the one that he's on, that Tony Williams is on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it was the VSOP album.
Or love
one,
that
one
tune.
Of the VSOP albums, yeah. Just. Yep.
Love it.
Yeah.
I have a chart for that somewhere.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, there are many really great versions of that, but that's just the one that really
reaches you, that gets you.
Yeah.
Isn't that something? There are just certain tunes that just that just, you know. There's so many great interpreters of great music, but there's a version that just it reaches you in a different way.
Yep.
And you never know what it's going to be, but there's something there, you mm-hmm. know. And sometimes it's not overt, brilliant musicality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like when the sum of the parts exceeds the whole vibe.
Yep.
And I love that.
Yeah.
You know, that's magical.
Yeah, and it was because of Tony Williams that was my favorite.
Yeah.
I mean, there were other great people. I can't remember who. But
I loved like in the mid '70s, the Believe It era, when he had you know the electric band with Alan Holdsworth and Alan Pasqua.
Yep.
Oh my God, those tunes, Fred, and Yeah. I mean, it's just great. And then hearing Alan Holdsworth, who was in so many ways unparalleled, mm-hmm. in terms of what he did on the instrument. He's really a one of one. People try to emulate him, but I don't think they really come close to his voice and his mm-hmm. His vocabulary. It's just mm-hmm. extraordinary. And that alchemy was just transcendent. It was just really some deep, deep stuff.
Were there people back then that you tried to emulate?
Inspired by, you know, Hendrix. I mean, Hendrix was like, my first concert I went to was Jimi Hendrix.
Wow.
And that was August 23rd, 1968.
Jeez, I saw him around that time.
Yeah, at the Singer Bowl, and he was on the bill with the Chambers Brothers, who were really enormous at that time.
Of course.
And Janis Joplin and Big Brother and the Soft Machine, all really notable acts.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were all mind-blowing. And I says, holy cow. And Janis just left the stage in cinders. I mean, it was like, holy shit, what's going to happen now?
Yeah.
Hendrix comes out, and I was transported.
Yeah.
And his first thing he played was, I think, Are You Experienced?
Oh, my.
You know, and it was like, mind blown. Never forget it. He was incandescent on stage. And I saw him three times live.
I saw him once in a big, basketball arena in Baltimore.
Oh, okay.
The Baltimore Bullets played at that time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So cool.
Yeah.
But, and then my second concert was Jeff Beck. The first band with Rod Stewart singing.
I saw them at the same venue.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that was killing, man. I'm so fortunate that, you know, in terms of my inspiration, initially, my spark was seeing the Beatles.
Huh?
There was something so fresh about that.
Uh-huh.
And when I first heard them, I didn't really know anything about music, but I knew it was something different and it was something fresh.
Yeah.
I was able to really discern at a very early age something that was either extraordinarily complex
mm-hmm.
or beautiful or mm-hmm. a combination of the both.
Huh.
And there was something unique. You know, some of the Beatle harmonies that they were doing, I didn't hear in traditional pop music, especially mm-hmm. at that time.
Yeah.
You know, it was a lot of 1-6-4-5 kind of post-doo-wop kind of into a pop thing.
Yeah.
You know, but there was something really unique, them doing like major six chords,
mm-hmm.
you know. Yeah, 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 yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, that last chord on that, you know, mm-hmm. of that song,
mm-hmm.
She Loves You, is just like, you know, you know, that was fresh.
Yeah.
And I didn't know it was a major six chord, you know, but I knew that it rung out differently from everything that I'd heard prior mm-hmm. to that.
And were you playing then?
No, I wasn't playing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, no, I hadn't picked up an instrument at that point. I picked up an instrument much later. My dad saved up money to get me an acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
And I played that until it fell apart.
Literally?
Literally. I mean, the bridge had just come off the body and everything.
Oh,
and then he saved up again, you know, because, you know, we're from the South Bronx. We didn't have much money.
Sure.
And so he had to save up his money. He bought me an electric guitar and an amp, and then I was on my own. After that, I bought my my own instruments, and, you know, so...
You must have been so grateful.
Oh, my God.
Ah.
And they were so supportive, too.
Yeah?
You know, they wasn't, well, gee, Eddie, you know, what if this doesn't work out? What are you going to do? You know, what's your plan B? And there was nothing about... There was never a word about what my backup was going to be.
Uh-huh.
They were so supportive. I was doing gigs at 15 and 16... Yeah.
Well, it must have been pretty obvious.
Yeah, I didn't abuse the liberties that they gave me because mm-hmm. that was the deal.
Yeah.
You know, the deal was, okay, you do your gigs, you do your six sets a night at the Peppermint Lounge, you come home, you take the D train all the way home, and you get up for school. You miss school, the deal's off.
Wow.
So, you know, they were firm that way, that I couldn't mess around with my education.
Uh-huh.
You know,
uh-huh.
I'm grateful.
Yeah.
So, I have great parents.
Yeah, good for you. Yeah. I wish I'd had it.
Oh, man.
You got a thing in New York coming up, don't you? Oh, wait a minute. Let's get back to the elephant.
Oh, yeah. So, elephant. So with Jason Crisaro, we went into the studio with Jack Daly, who's uh-huh. played with Lenny Kravitz, and Little Steven, and a great bass player, and then Tony James, formerly of Billy Squire and uh-huh. Cyndi Lauper, and myself. And Alan Childs, formerly of David Bowie, and he's out on tour right now with John Waite.
Uh-huh.
He plays on a track. And And we cut these tunes. And then years pass, and I move away from New York and go through a divorce. I mean, just a real tumultuous shit life.
Sure, life, yes.
Life. And Jason was the kind of buddy that he was steadfast. And as a dear friend, and even after I moved here, I'd speak to him once or twice a week.
Sure.
We'd always catch up on stuff. And and we always downloaded. And he was such a brilliant engineer. I don't think that he was really kind of recognized as much as he should have been for his work.
Mm-hmm.
But if I encourage people to look at his body of work and the records that he's been a part of. It's really an extraordinary career. And after he passed, I went to the memorial that was that power station at Studio A.
Wow.
Which is a place where, you know, where he started.
Yeah.
And where a lot of the hit records, whether it was Power Station, Some Like It Hot, or was it Duran Duran Reflex that he recorded and mixed, or View to a Kill from the James Bond movie, or, you know, on and on and on.
Yeah.
And that was like home base, you know, not only for him, but for me, because I recorded there with so many artists through the years. Really a shrine as far as I'm concerned, as far as a studio
is
concerned.
Give us a taste of that.
Pardon me?
Like who?
Who I played with there?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, Bonnie Tyler, Meatloaf, Steve Winwood, my own bands, Chaka Khan. Oh my gosh. Joe Cocker. I mean, just a bunch of different, Robert Palmer. You know,
Jaws just dropped.
Yeah, I was living in that place, man. Yeah. I cut a track with Eric Clapton in there.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Huh. In Studio A, which is this enormous room. It's a great studio.
Yeah.
Yeah. So at his memorial, his sisters found the tapes in the basement because I'd been asking about him, but he had becoming progressively ill, and cancer took him, and he was just too weak. He couldn't even go downstairs to find the tapes.
Mm.
But his sisters did, Jane and Jill, you know? And
were they mixed?
No, they weren't mixed. The 24. I don't think it's Jill Corsaro. It's Jane and Julie. That's
okay.
It. Jane and Julie Corsaro. And they were just the 24 masters. You know, there was a 2-inch. There was a 2-inch, not a 2-inch, but like a 1/4-inch of some mixes. I took them. The first thing I do, I come back to Portland and. Engineer that I work with, Justin Phelps, over at Hallowed Halls, he was able to transfer them for me because it's a process of you have to bake the analog tapes because those things are, you know, they're old.
Yeah.
And so you need to put them at a particular, in a confection oven, at a particular temperature for like 11 hours for all the stuff to adhere back to the celluloid itself.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so you bake them and then you transfer as soon as possible to your Pro Tools or your digital, format, and it transferred beautifully. And then I completed it. I took my time with it. Then COVID came, and it was like a whole confluence of things that just kind of like, you know, life gets in the way sometimes, you know. And but I was able to finish it, and the artwork is my son's artwork, Davis. And he's a brilliant young artist.
So is it out?
No, it's coming out. Actually, it's actually being manufactured right now. So it's mixed, it's mastered, the artwork has been submitted, so now everything's just being assembled, so
to
speak.
That is so exciting.
So 4 tunes on there. And then my plans are for the balance of this year to start in earnest recording my next new album of music. So I'm really excited about that. And I've got these nuggets of songs that I'm really kind of happy about, and they're going to be really different. I want it to be different.
Different from what? You've played everything.
Yeah, different from my previous efforts.
I
want to, you know, just make a couple of shifts here harmonically and you know, in terms of content and direction. And it's still going to be rocking and in your face, but there are going to be some curveballs there, man. I just always have to add things in there that are just off the beaten path. You know, I think that's something I picked up from Robert Palmer because he was such an eclectic artist that he would have a tune that's heavy metal, then he'd have something that's kind of like a high life. You know, so he was really he was that broad in terms of his scope of musical appreciation and how he composed his music as well.
Well, I can't wait to play that on the radio.
It's gonna be fun. It's gonna be interesting stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
Really.
Looking forward to it.
It's really great. I just got a a newly re-released Maurice White album.
Whoa.
Yeah. You know the people from Omnivore? Omnivore Records?
No.
They keep winning Grammys for their packaging. Cheryl Pavelski, who's just my favorite. She's just amazing. She won the Grammy for packaging the Mr. Rogers album. She just won for they re-release and repackage wonderful music.
Wow.
And she helped compile this one.
Because
it's stuff
great.
That was released after he died, shortly after he died, but some that had never been released.
Wow, that's extraordinary.
And I got to play that on the radio immediately, so it's just...
Oh, man. I never met Maurice, but I work with some of the guys from... I work with Larry Dunn, who was part of Earth, Wind & Fire.
Yeah?
I did three albums with him, with Lenny White. Huh. And a lot of the members of Earth, Wind & Fire played on those albums. Uh-huh. A lot of guys from the horn section, the Sea Wind horns, along with the Earth, Wind & Fire horns. And Jerry Hay arranged some horns for a tune that I wrote with Lenny and on that album.
Did you ever know Charles Stepney?
No, we never met him, but I was an enormous fan. He was like their mentor
in the
early 70s.
They were his thing.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And when he passed away, it was like, whoa.
Oh. What an extraordinary band. I saw them really in their prime.
Did you?
Alive. At least three times.
Yeah.
And I remember hearing, being at Larry Dunn's house. He lived over in Brentwood in L.A.
Uh-huh.
And this is the night of the, man, it's a long time ago. This is Sugar Ray, the first fight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so we watched the fight over at his house.
Yeah.
But prior to the fight, you know, he played the rhythm track to In the Stone off of the I Am album. It hadn't been released at that point.
Huh.
So, you know, we're in the studio. Ba-dum-gum, ba-da-da-dum, ba-da-da-dum. Oh, man, it's like we're blown away. It was just, that's a great memory.
That's amazing. Of course, Sugar Ray was, he was our guy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from Baltimore.
Okay.
I mean,
I love Sugar Ray, man.
Yeah.
Mano Zepeda was a giant, man, but I was in the Sugar Ray camp.
Yeah.
Lo siento, mi gente latino, man.
Do you have to go?
I've got about 15 more minutes.
Okay, good.
Yeah, yeah.
Good. Because we don't want to.
No, this is a great conversation, man. I'm just loving reminiscing and stuff like that.
Yeah. So when is that going to come out?
I'm thinking it's going to be out within the next 3 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm expecting, you know, a phone call or a note that, you know, that they'll be shipped, you know, so.
Wow.
I'll make sure you get a copy.
Please.
It's really in your face rock
Please.
And stuff. It's not,
yeah,
it's not,
yeah.
it's like really in your face stuff.
Great.
So, yeah. Yeah. It's fun.
Awesome. Awesome. That's terrific.
Yeah, I can't wait to, because I'm going to have to go into some heavier rehearsals, you know, to make sure those tunes are right to play live, because they're big sounding. So I'm excited about that.
What band would you play with them? Play them with?
With my guys. It was just a matter of time just to rehearse it a little bit more.
The same ones that are going to be at Jack London?
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Gonna have
we've been playing
gig?
On and off. John's been playing with me for over 10 years.
Yeah.
And Ramsey's been with me since the beginning, 14 years ago.
Ramzini.
Yeah. The great Ramzini. And Anthony was there at the beginning. My first gig, Anthony was extraordinary drummer.
Yeah. Ramsey just played a gig. I had a hand in booking the Seaside Jazz and Blues Festival, and I wanted to get him in playing solo.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, because he has all those amazing solo records. You know that.
Oh
that,
yeah.
They wrote all the Duke Ellington tunes.
Billy Strayhorn.
He has this amazing solo Billy Strayhorn album.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about a genius, you know, writing Lush Life at 16 years old.
Yeah, I know how that could happen.
That's like, that is...
How could that happen? How did he know that?
That's divine.
Yeah.
That's something providential and kind of like, you know, that's really extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like that's kind of like Mozart shit, writing his first symphony, as a teenager.
Yeah.
You know, it's incredible.
Well, you know, when the spirit takes over you,
yeah.
When you're working on something, it doesn't matter whether it's writing or playing or whatever, you know, when that takes over, there's nothing like it.
I think that's the hardest standard to sing.
Really? Johnny Hartman is the sort of version of record for Lush Life.
Yeah,
do you think?
Yeah, I think so. Who else have I heard sing it? I've heard Gaga sing it.
Really? Oh. And that makes sense.
She sings the shit out of it.
Well, she can tackle anything. She's fearless.
Oh, she sang that song like a boss.
Yeah.
She really, really delivered with that tune.
Yeah.
But that song, I mean, the key changes and everything are just like really, and the pivot notes are really you need to know your shit.
Yeah.
Because it's not some sort of modal thing.
Right.
You know, it's you're singing melodies to changes that are structured.
Yeah.
So if you're interpreting one note differently than what's supposed to be, it makes the song not right.
Yeah.
You know? Of course, there's nuances and stuff in terms of interpretation.
Sure.
But in terms of melody, especially with singing standards, I'm kind of like old school. You know, in the sense that you know, interpret the melody, you know, but sing the melody, you know.
Mm.
So I love listening to the American standards. It's just really, you know, whether it's Gershwin or Harold Arlen and Cole Porter, you know, it's just really.
My favorite interpreter of standards was Betty Carter.
Oh yeah,
that's amazing. I interviewed her one time.
How was that?
I was in heaven.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know, she was the best. She was like, she's so brilliant. She's brilliant about talking about that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
You know?
I remember talking to Robert Palmer because we did an album called Don't Explain where he covers Don't Explain.
Yeah.
And he was just talking how those songs are so different to sing.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to approach the microphone in such a different way than you do if you're singing a pop tune or a rock tune.
Uh-huh.
And I think he did a really good, really great job on that, you know, and even covering Marvin Gaye's, Mercy, Mercy Me, I Want You, which is not, you know, it's not a standard, but it's a
standard.
R&B standard.
It's a standard.
Yeah.
That's definitely a standard.
And he put his foot in it, man. He sang it in his full voice, too. Marvin sings his in falsetto.
Mm-hmm.
Robert sang his in full voice, and I think he did that intentionally just to create a distinction.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And he did a really, really great job with that. But yeah, I mean, all the great singers. I remember seeing Tony Bennett at Radio City, and I was sitting in the mezzanine. Nice seats. And, you know, halfway through the show, he told the house mixer to turn off the microphone. And he sang Fly Me to the Moon a cappella.
Wow.
At Radio City Music Hall. 6,000 people. And he belted out a verse. And everybody in that place heard it. It was extraordinary. You know, that was really, really something special. You know, no band, just voice.
Did you ever play there?
Yes. Played there a couple of times.
With who?
Robert Palmer.
Ah.
Yeah. There's something so majestic and grand about that venue.
Sure.
The vibe of it, it's 6,000 people.
Yeah.
Which is a nice size, but it's not the garden.
Right.
This is more than three times as large, but it seems like it's much larger than the garden when you step out on that stage.
Mm.
It's such a deep stage because, you know, all the different productions that they can do there. It's not only for cinema, but it's got a very deep stage like the Met, which I've played. You know, it's just like, I mean, that stage is just deep, you know, for all the opera productions and everything. But there's a feeling that you go out there, man, and it's intimidating at first.
Yeah.
It really is.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, you know, but you just embrace it and you fall into your rhythm of what you're about and stuff. But when you walk out on that stage, it's a very different look from the stage than other venues, from, you know, the vantage of looking out into the audience.
Yeah.
It's really, it's extraordinary, you know, and it can be intimidating, but you got to do what you got to do, man.
You're a fortunate gentleman.
I am. You know, I worked real hard, but I'm lucky as well. I've been fortunate.
Yeah. You have to.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, no, there has to be an element of luck to this. I find that luck, you generate luck, I believe.
Yes.
You know, you attract it. I'm a big believer in that. And I don't know how, but I know there was a drive and a determination in me that I knew what I wanted to do really early on.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to play in clubs incessantly.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at it as a form of education.
Yeah.
Because I really wanted to play on records,
mm-hmm.
and do concerts. So it was kind of lofty dreams that I had,
sure.
you know, which I was thinking about. And I would leave no stone unturned, you know, relative to auditions at that time. You get the mm-hmm. Village Voice, you see what's happening. And or if you're lucky enough to get a phone call, so-and-so's auditioning here, give these people a call, see if you can set up a, you know, an audition date. And real kind of old school, you know,
sure.
cattle call stuff.
Yeah.
But you have to have thick skin. And a lot of the younger people, I don't think they're prepared for failure because you have to fail to succeed.
Right.
And that's what a lot of people don't seem to realize, that you have to keep trying, and there are going to be some downfalls and failures. But that's part of the process. And once you get to where you want, or you feel like you've accomplished something, you look at that journey as something that was really special.
Right.
You know, because right now, at this stage of my life, when I think about all my friends, all my best friends in the business, you know, and I think there's one common denominator, and there's a drive.
Yes.
And there's a drive to, like, shit, mm-hmm. man, I want to do something. Mm-hmm. I want to find a gig. I want to make a name for myself.
Mm-hmm.
I want to learn my instrument to the best of my ability. I want to try to create my own style, or find an amalgam of ideas
mm-hmm.
where you could find what your own sauce is,
mm-hmm.
you know, mm-hmm. and then you go for it. And then if you're fortunate enough to play on a hit song or a track that makes some noise, then it's just like the movie business.
Yes.
Oh, I want Brad
that
Pitt
guy.
On this. I want this guy. I want so-and-so. I want, Timothy Chalamet, or whoever the actor or actress may be.
And they're still calling you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're still calling you.
Yeah, yeah. Not as much, because I tell people, you know, you know, when you're hot, you're hot. And there's a time when all this stuff passes, and they want the younger kids, and they want the young blood,
right?
You know, because a lot of this pop music is youth serving youth,
right?
So, and
were you a Jerry Reed fan?
Jerry Reed, man.
When you're hot, you're hot. And I said, thanks a lot,
man. I've listened to everything, man. If I'm fortunate that my older brothers, I mean, they. You know, we had Sun Ra, we had Miles Davis, Tony Bennett, Bob Dylan. I had the Beatles and Hendrix and Cream and Purple Harem and so it was everything from all that stuff and James Brown. It was, you know, Sun Ra blaring out, man, with that Cosmos stuff.
I interviewed both James Brown and Sun Ra.
Wow, that's deep.
It was deep.
I never met James Brown. I've heard he was quite a character.
I tell this story a lot, and I haven't told it for a while, but I went to see James Brown came through Baltimore because all his businesses in Baltimore were all going under. He owned a radio station, he owned a motel, he owned a beauty salon. They were all going under, and he came into town to testify in court. And I went down to the court, and I walk in, and there he was on the stand, on the witness stand, and he was in fact testifying.
Wow.
And I mean testifying. He goes, Judge, if I was Chrysler Corporation, you wouldn't be doing this to me. And of course, he was right.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So I said, can we shoot an interview later on this evening? He said, sure. So I go there and I said, Mr. Brown, after some preliminary questions, I go, Mr. Brown, what is it? How do you do this? What is it that you do to make people lose their minds? He goes, I kick off on the one and let the boogie do the rest.
On the one.
On the one.
That's where the funk is.
Yeah. Of course, back then, that was in, I don't know, 78, 79. Nobody knew what that was. Nobody. Of course, people.
If you're a musician, you wouldn't know. But really kind of like,
But
you know.
For a fan, what the hell is that? Yeah. You know, so I had to learn that, you know.
Oh, that's
and
a great story,
Sun Ra,
man.
And then Sun Ra started telling me that he was from the planet Zyrakon.
Wow.
And I believed him.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I wanted to believe him.
Well, you know, somebody that's there's you know, there are these artists that come along, and I there's a freedom there.
Yeah.
And to me, the highest compliment I could give someone, whether it's a progressive jazz artist or a pop songwriter or a country writer, when something is so profound and hits you in a way that you're free.
Yes.
There's a freedom in that is really emblematic of greatness.
Yeah.
You know, that's really just some heavy shit, you know, when you think about that Cosmos stuff or what Train was playing towards the end when he was really taking it out and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's a freedom there, you know, and it doesn't matter. You know, I have a good friend that, you know, that writes film scores, and he always, you know, sends me stuff to share, and you know, it's just like, it blows me away because he's so brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I says, man, bro, you're free. You know, that's the highest compliment I could give someone in terms of their scope of their talent and what they're putting out there.
Yeah.
Because there's an originality there. There's a freshness there. It's like there's a respect for convention, but there's also a wild streak.
Yes. Oh, definitely.
Know? And, you know, because I'm a big believer, if you're going to take shit out, you really need to learn the fundamentals before you take the shit out.
Yes.
You know, because you have to start somewhere before you get somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, and I think those fundamental values in playing stuff that's quote unquote, you know, traditional or whatever, you know, it's a floor to build your building above.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, metaphorically, you know, and I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, those guys, they used to scare me to death. I interviewed Cecil Taylor one time.
Wow.
And I was so scared.
Stuff,
I was so scared that he was going to eat me for lunch. And I called up Gary Giddens at the Village Voice. I said, listen, I knew they knew each other. I said, listen, I'm going to have Cecil Taylor on my, I was doing a network radio show then. I'm going to have Cecil Taylor on my show this week. Would you like to join us? Meanwhile, I hadn't talked to Cecil Taylor yet.
Okay. How did it go?
Well, Gary Giddens said yes.
Awesome.
So I called up Cecil Taylor and said, listen, could you do my show with me and Gary Giddens? Gary Giddens being the magic name.
Okay.
And he was wonderful. He was just fabulous.
Yep.
There was nothing negative about it, you know?
Awesome.
And I mean, it was one of those great moments.
That's great. That's a great story.
Like this is.
Hey,
man, I interviewed Eddie Martinez today. No, you didn't. You had a conversation. Oh, okay.
Oh, that's even better. That's awesome.
Well, listen, I know you got to run. I really appreciate you stopping by and
spending
some
time. Oh, man,
this
was so much fun.
Yeah,
thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, man.
You know,
and as we like to say at the end of these things, that's entertainment.
Thank you. Bye-bye, everybody.